Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live. Only on Netflix.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Oil prices hit an 11-year low yesterday. Globally, the industry has cut 250,000 jobs. And after Paris, the world is freshly committed to cutting the very use of fossil fuels. For consumers, the oil price collapse means big savings. It's rippling through geopolitics, too, whole economies, and the future of renewable energies. This hour on Point, we're looking at cheap oil and what it means. The impacts are all over the place. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the huge drop in oil prices? What's it mean in your life, your region, our future? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, SpaceX recovers a rocket from orbital flight. We'll look at exactly how SpaceX brought that big booster back down for a pinpoint landing on Cape Canaveral. First time ever for them. But first, joining me now from New York is Gregory Zuckerman. He covers the energy industry for The Wall Street Journal, author of The Frackers. Greg Zuckerman, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Hey, great to be here.
And with us from Carbondale, Colorado, is Phil Verleger, owner and president of P.K. Verleger, the energy consulting firm. Phil, welcome back to you as well.
It's good to be back.
Greg, let me come first to you. Why are prices down so much? You say it's because Saudi Arabia is trying to do what?
So about a year, over a year ago, so they made a proclamation. They said, we're sick and tired of losing market share to U.S. producers, and including the frackers, as we call them, the shale producers in North Dakota and Oklahoma and Texas and throughout this country. And we're going to fight to get it back. And they've got other enemies as well. They've got the Russians. They've got the Iranians. They've got all kinds of reasons to push prices lower. And again, they are fighting for market share, and they've unleashed their forces on the world. And we're all benefiting to some extent as a result.
So Saudi Arabia is letting the oil flow, but $110 a barrel must sound a lot better to them, too, than what, 36, 38 this week?
That's true. They're feeling pain, but they can handle it for a few years or so, which is why I would argue we're all going to be enjoying low oil prices for the next few years. They are in this for the long haul, is my understanding, in terms of trying to combat both U.S. production, but offshore, Arctic, all kinds of oil sands in Canada. They've got all kinds of enemies and competitors in this global energy market. And just taking a step back, the remarkable thing is that we're a competitor. We're one of the big three. The United States just a few years ago was running out of both oil and gas, and now we're going to be exporting both the natural gas and oil. So it's a dramatic shift both for our country and for the world.
Phil Verleger in Colorado, what does it mean for the United States? There's been so much more production here in recent years. Natural gas and oil, of course, fracking put a whole lot of gas in the market. Natural gas prices way down as well. Lowest level since 1999 is the headline I'm looking at here. Is the Saudi strategy putting dire pressure on American fossil fuel producers?
Well, it's putting pressure, but let me step back for a second because I have a very different interpretation than Greg does.
Okay.
For 40 years, I've been following this since I finished my PhD at MIT in 1971, we've been operating under what's called, an economic theory called the hoteling theory. The view of the hoteling theory is that oil not produced today but produced tomorrow is worth more. Mm-hmm. And this is because oil is seen as a finite resource. About a year ago, Ali Naimi, Saudi oil minister, asked the question, which is very poignant, is there a black swan out there such that there will be no demand in 2050 for oil?
Mm-hmm.
And he concluded that's right. And what the Saudis have realized is, first, they have no market power. Now, this is an economic explanation, which means if they cut production, and even they cut production enough for prices to go to $100 a barrel, their revenue goes down. They're in the role of a big corn farmer in Iowa. Corn farmer cuts production, prices go up a bit, but the corn farmer's income goes way down. And part of that has to do with our
because they'd have to cut so much to bring it to push the prices up that high that net net they'd be out of money.
Their revenue goes down. The price elasticities of demand
mm-hmm.
are too low.
Mm-hmm.
Renewables are coming, and renewables will keep coming. Russia will come. The U.S. and the higher the price, the more we produce. And the second thing they realized is that it wasn't the oil that they didn't produce today; they could produce tomorrow for more money. The oil they don't produce today will never be produced. So they have changed fundamentally the game, and as have the Kuwaitis, as have two or three other countries there. And you could hear it in the statements made at the OPEC meeting. Yes, we will cut production if others will cut as well. And the numbers they are using are, I think, mine. But if everybody else cuts 3 barrels, we'll cut 1 barrel.
Okay.
That means our revenue goes up.
Yep.
And that's what a cartel is. And they see no chance of other people cutting 3 barrels for 1 barrel that they contribute, and so they're going to keep producing. Now, to answer your question, what this means for the U.S. is less than what it means for Canada. Their targets really aren't the U.S. Their target's Venezuela, which is falling apart, and which probably within a year will see production drop by at least 50 or 70% because they have no money.
Mm-hmm.
And Canada, where the costs are so high and the Canadians are having trouble getting the oil out. So in Canada, now some oil sells for less than $20 a barrel.
And are you talking tar sands oil there, Phil?
That's tar sands, correct. And because the price they get is the Houston price, less transportation, less quality differential.
As you describe this, and I want to hear more, but may I just note here, what you've just described sounds to my layman's ears like a radical situation.
It is.
A complete turnover of old assumptions, and the Saudis saying, fire sale, sell it now while it's still worth something.
That's exactly right. This is like the sales that the stores are having now for Christmas gifts because people didn't buy as much. It's, you know, the toys that are on the shelf on December 26th are essentially worthless. You know, you've got to have it on Christmas Day.
But explain that. Does that mean that they think that renewable energies are going to come along and compete with them, or that the economy is going to be so bad in the world that no one's going to need the oil? Or what? Why is the hotel theory turned upside down?
Hoteling theory.
Hoteling, excuse me.
That's all right. And nobody talks about it. It's first because they see the need to limit fossil fuel. I mean, Naimi's question was in context of the upcoming, he made it a year ago, COP21 meeting that just finished in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes that less fossil fuel will be used, less fossil fuel must be used. If you look, there's a great group in England called the Carbon Tracker Initiative. It comes out of LSE.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking now about $2.5 trillion of booked assets by fossil fuel companies being unproducible, have to be written off if we're going to survive. And the Saudis have paid a lot more attention to this and worked a lot more carefully with this than any of the major oil companies. Now, the Saudis don't do this very publicly, but Naimi has gone to all these meetings, unlike the CEOs of oil companies, and he has worked with them. And he has, I think, come to the conclusion that only a portion of the world's hydrocarbon resources are going to be produced, and he wants to make sure it's the Saudi resources that are produced, not the Venezuelan, not the Canadian.
Pause there for a second, Phil. Gregory Zuckerman, what do you make of this view of the oil world? This is radical. This says it's going to stay in the ground. Never mind peak oil. We can't use it. We won't use it. A lot of it's just going to stay in the ground, so the Saudis want to sell it now, whatever the price.
Listen, to try to get inside of the Saudis, the minds of the Saudis is quite challenging. I'm open to that view that they are more optimistic than the rest of us on U.S. renewables and the adoption. Right now, about 7% of our electricity comes from renewables. Now, for the Saudis to be more optimistic than we all are on how that will grow, that'd be nice. I'd love it to grow much more rapidly than it's growing. But I'm a little skeptical, and I don't think it's coincidental that the Saudis unleashed this challenge to global competitors, oil competitors, just as U.S. production had soared from about 5 million barrels a day to 9.6 last year. So to me, they're trying. They have a lot of enemies out there, including U.S. production, and they're trying to cut off people's opportunity to take market share. But for them to be more optimistic about the growth of renewables, I'd love to see that.
Describe for us U.S. production from 5 million barrels, I guess that's a day of oil, over what period to 9.6?
Since around 2005, and that's the shocking thing.
That's a huge run-up. What's happening as the Saudis have opened the spigots? Where's the U.S. production now?
It hasn't dropped as much as one would have expected. So we're about 9.3 million barrels a day, down from a peak of around 9.6. Most people in the field expect something like 8.8 or so next year. So it's going to drop. And when you travel the country, you see real pain. You places like North Dakota and places in Pennsylvania and Texas and Louisiana. So they're firing people. We've lost a lot of jobs in the industry. About 1,200 rigs, or about two-thirds of the U.S. rigs have been decommissioned. And you've gotten jobs lost just in Texas, about 50,000 jobs. So there is intense pain being felt, but production hasn't really plummeted.
Phil Verleger, with the price so far down, is it a slaughter out there in the U.S. Oil industry?
Yes, it is, and we don't really know what our production is. The weekly production DOE produces is based on a model, and the model's been wrong. If we drove down to Houston to give a speech about 3 weeks ago and went across the Panhandle, which is mostly stripper wells, and we do this once every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, all the wells were working. We saw about 600 pump jacks. This year, 550 of the 600 pump jacks weren't working. They all shut down. So the stripper production is way down. That doesn't get really reported until 6 months, 9 months down. So probably our production will be closer to 8 million barrels a day or a little lower next year. But if you look at what people are doing, and the Saudis understand this. And by the way, I agree with Greg. I think we're going to have low prices for quite a while. And they're worried, but they really want the market share, and they really want to pump their oil. What we're going to see is firms in the fracking business driving their costs down. A year ago, costs were probably twice as high as they are now. In addition, what people do now is drill wells, but don't complete them. They call them these DUCs, D-U-Cs, drilled but uncompleted.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a very large number of these wells. And so as soon as prices go back up, these wells will be completed, if prices go back up or if costs come down. And the Saudis have a better count on really what's going on there than anybody else.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about cheap oil and its global impact on politics, geopolitics, economies, and renewable energy. We will look at as well. Greg Zuckerman is with us from the Wall Street Journal. Phil Verleger from PK Verleger in Carbondale, Colorado, with us today. You can join us in this hour. Are you celebrating below $2 a gallon gas? Are you looking past the Prius to the big SUV? What about the future of the planet, the climate? How is cheap oil changing the world, your world? And are you in the oil business one way or another and seeing the layoffs? Is this what we need to wind this business down to stop climate change? Or does cheap oil, cheap natural gas out there too, make renewable energy look too darn expensive? Where does it stop? Nobody quite sure. Here's John Kingston with McGraw-Hill Financial talking with Reuters about low oil prices. Said they could still fall significantly, he said this week.
It's been a game of chicken for quite some time, and quite frankly, nobody's blinked there. And so I don't know that anybody's going to blink. You know, the U.S. production is not controlled by some sort of central entity that decides to cut output.
And there's just one view. Greg Zuckerman, pluses and minuses to this super low oil price. It's great on family budgets. Everybody who's having to pay for gas or use oil in other ways, natural gas, knows that. But big picture, pluses and minuses to this collapse, really, in oil prices.
Well, yeah, any consumer is helped. Anybody in that business is hurt. The thing that I'm most concerned about, quite honestly, when I did this book, the thing I came away from was I wasn't worried the fracking business and the energy business. I wasn't as worried as others when I talked to scientists and people in the fields about things like chemicals and methane and earthquakes. All that can be dealt with. What I do worry about is getting addicted to really inexpensive, cheap fossil fuels. And if we all believe that sustainables, renewables are the future and we want to move there, then I do worry that lower energy prices, both oil and gas, will further this addiction. Now, I'm encouraged to some extent because both Paris, the continuation of the tax credits, which Congress looks like they're going to approve, and just about investments. When I talk to people on Wall Street, KKR, big private equity mm-hmm. firms, they're still investing in renewables. So that's encouraging, but I'm cautious as well.
Phil, does the you say that the Saudi oil minister thinks people are going to leave oil in the ground, but presumably that's not on a market basis. If prices are low, the market would say, take it out. That could be wrong for the planet, but the market would say, take it out. What's the presumption there that governments are going to get so serious about this that they'll make it somehow unattractive?
No, I think to the contrary, if they keep it down, less oil will come out of the ground because a lot of the oil is not economic at these prices, and even LNG. Now, the congressional bill that passed, the budget bill that passed Friday,
allowing U.S. exports of oil for the first time in a long time.
It was a pyrrhic victory for the oil industry. If they get another victory like that, they're dead.
Why? Because thought it was a gift.
Well, one, with low prices, we're not going to export. That's not going to happen. Two, the bill did a little something for transportation. If you do the tax things, and I used to work at Treasury, and I spent 6 hours working out the magnitude of the deal for transporting oils. It works out to be 7 cents for every $1 an oil company spends on moving oil. Nothing there. Meantime, all the tax credits came through, and solar is now competitive in many parts of the world, particularly the United States, and wind is getting more competitive.
And you're talking tax credits for renewables, for solar and wind.
Renewables. Mm-hmm. For example, the government will pay you, reduce your taxes by 30 cents for every dollar you spend on a charging device for a Tesla you put in. So essentially, government pays for it if you're in the 30% tax bracket.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that if we look at consumer theory today, and I know this is a bit obscure, consumers like to buy things in bundles, like buying their cell phones. You want a fixed bill for the month. You don't want uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla and a number of the renewables are offering this for all sorts of types of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the oil industry is antediluvian. They're just way back in the last century. They figure, okay, we put the price up and you pay whatever you pay. If you go through the detailed consumer expenditure data that I do once a month and the BEA puts out when they report GDP, you find all the money that consumers aren't spending on gasoline, looking at the detailed numbers, is going into savings. Consumers aren't going to restaurants and so on. They don't, partly they don't trust the oil industry. It's clear. It's really clear in the data. And one of the things you find is that as companies can sell transportation, car service, and so on in bundles,
mm-hmm.
consumers shift over there just because they take the uncertainty out of the pocketbook expenditures. Yes, they buy SUVs. Carpenters, construction workers have to use trucks to get to the job and others. But the SUVs they're buying now are replacing older SUVs. And if you look at the work that comes out of the University of Michigan, these are a lot more efficient SUVs so that the fuel economy is much better than it was in 2007.
So you're talking just new dynamics here, that if you don't look at this in, as you say, an antediluvian way, these are sort of unexpected economic dynamics pushing toward renewables in spite of the low oil price.
That's right, because you can't develop the oil sands in Canada. Venezuela can't get firms to come in. Just last night, Chevron entered sold 80% of its natural gas LNG production from Australia to China, and they sold it for a price that's about 40% of what they expected to make. So, they've locked in a loss, not locked in a huge loss, but they've locked in a loss. And so, if you want to look at this, the big oil companies that have gambled on the high-cost projects are going to lose. And if they want to keep their dividends, they're going to have to cut their capital expenditures massively. And so there's going to be a lot less oil and a lot less coal. Now, what's going to happen is oil is, I use the corn farmer analogy, oil is the new corn. Prices will go up when supply gets tight, but they're going to be volatile the way corn prices are volatile, and we're not going to see a rush in to spend a huge capital spending on a big $30 billion projects like the Tengiz project in Asia, just because the companies, A, aren't going to have the money, B, can't count on the prices staying high for a long time.
Hard to go after that extreme oil if you've got that kind of volatility in the market. Phil Verleger, please stand by. And Greg Zuckerman, we're going to talk in just a moment with Dan Riker. He's right in the middle of the whole renewables scene. But a couple of our listeners first, if I may. Joseph in Hendersonville, Tennessee. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you see?
It's amazing. I've been in Tennessee. I'm originally from Syracuse, New York,
yeah.
But I'm retired, and I live in Hendersonville, Tennessee. It's about 17 miles out of Nashville. The gas prices are so low here, I'm astounded.
What is it now?
Anywhere from $1.69 to $1.58 a gallon.
Wow. I haven't seen that in a long time. So what are you doing with the extra spending money in your pocket, Joseph?
Well, you know, Santa's coming
yep.
in a few days. So maybe I can get my kids, a couple of things that they were asking Santa for. So,
did you ever think you'd see them go down that low again, gas prices?
No, when I was in Syracuse, New York, it was anywhere from $3.25, $3.55.
Yeah.
I mean, this is regular unleaded.
Yeah.
And, you know, to come down to Tennessee and to see what's going on with the Saudis and the oil flooding the market and the prices dropping dramatically, I think it's kind of great for the consumers. I'm just hoping that, as your other guest was saying, that when the demand goes up, of course, the prices it's going to go up again, you know. But this has been great, Tom. I mean, $1.58. I mean, my goodness.
Joseph, feeling good with $1.58 gas. We'll see what that does to consumption, to the profile of cars that Americans are driving. But we hear Phil Verleger saying there are reasons that may not spike back up. Joe, thanks for your call. Rick in Austin, Texas. Rick, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm loving the gas prices. I'm in Austin. We don't have any natural gas or gasoline or mm-hmm. oil refineries here, mm-hmm. so there's not a lot of work for us in that industry.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of family in Houston, and they're suffering, but they're suffering in brand-new cars and brand-new houses that they've been, you know, making a killing for years in these plants.
So they've had their good times, but not good times now. Do you feel sorry for the oil companies, Rick, or that's just the way it goes?
You know, a few years back, the big three was going to our government with their hand out. I kept wondering then how come the oil companies weren't loaning the big three money.
Oh, to the auto manufacturers.
Those cars run on oil, right?
Yeah.
They were reporting record profits.
Yes, they were. Oil was. Yes, it was.
There's going to be dry eyes right here.
Well, Rick, dry eyes in Texas, that corner of Texas anyway. And, of course, the oil companies didn't have to go and bail them out. The government did it for them. Gregory Zuckerman, Phil Verleger, please stand by. Dan Riker joins us right now. He's chairman and president of the American Council on Renewable Energy. Executive Director of the Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance out at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's worked a lot in energy in several administrations here. Assistant Secretary of Energy for Energy Efficiency, Renewable Energy. Dan Riker, thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
A lot of people might look at these very low oil prices and low natural gas prices, and we know that the energy flow is not interchangeable with what comes out of solar and wind and more. But still, those energy prices way down there could look like a hurdle for the healthy development of renewables. Is it, Dan?
You know, to a large extent, it is not, for several reasons. One, the prices for solar and wind, as Phil mentioned earlier, have really been dropping substantially. Solar down 80% over the last 5 years.
Are you talking the consumer price or the to install the facilities?
The price that one pays mm-hmm. up front for these various technologies, the price of the solar panels and the related equipment,
mm-hmm.
down very substantially.
Mm-hmm.
You add to that the Paris Climate Agreement, which is giving renewables a huge boost all over the world, And then just last week, as we heard earlier, the Congress extended some tax credits for solar and wind another 5 years. So you put that package together, and yes, in a certain sense, lower oil and natural gas prices are presenting some serious competition, but the renewable energy industry is growing very quickly all over the world.
So is the Saudi oil minister right? As Phil Verleger presents him here, he's afraid that renewables and restrictions on fossil fuel emissions are going to end up eating oil's lunch, eating the Saudis' lunch. Are you going to do that, Dan?
Well, in fact, the Saudi minister went on to say that Saudi Arabia was and in fact currently is going to build a big, big solar industry in order to get the country off of oil over the next several decades. So the Saudis are actually playing on both sides of this equation, obviously pumping lots and lots of oil, doing what they can on oil prices, but at the same time, they're hedging their bets with a major investment in solar and other renewables.
But here's the thing. It was only a couple of years ago, Tom Friedman and many others were saying, if we don't put a real price on oil that takes into effect its poor effects on the climate, we're never going to get renewables off to the kind of robust footing that they need to have. Was he wrong?
Well, I think what we didn't foresee, many didn't foresee, is just how quickly the price of renewables would drop. And that's been the startling result that no one really anticipated. And you add to that both national mandates around climate change and then this recent Paris Agreement, where, in effect, we're beginning to put a price on carbon on fossil fuels all over the world. So those two things come together, quickly dropping prices and increasing mandates around cutting our fossil fuel use, and we are where we are.
Greg, you're listening to all this in New York. Are we dreaming here? Is there some kind of Saudi jujitsu where suddenly this all changes and we're back in high oil and wondering what we were thinking when everybody thought low oil prices might go on and on?
Well, my personal view is that we're going to have low prices for the next few years, but at some point the Saudis won't be able to take this pain. They have a young, growing population. Their foreign reserves are down sharply just over the past year. They're running deficit. And it's okay for them. They can handle the pain and try to put pressure on both the U.S. producers, Iran, Russia, and others. But at some point, they're going to say, okay, maybe it's worth pursuing some sort of grand bargain. Maybe you do a deal in Syria, you do something with Russia. But for the next few years, I do think we'll have low prices. And it's also important to focus on the demand side. So a lot of our conversation has been on the supply side, mm-hmm. both renewables and others. But demand is very encouraging as well. You look over in China and their use of coal, the growth is really dramatically falling. They see a need to shift, and it's obvious. You walk around Beijing, you can see a need to shift from coal.
So dirty, and so filthy. The air.
Yeah, and we ourselves in the United States have shifted in large part. We're shipping coal abroad now because they still buy our coal in Europe. But in the U.S., natural gas is rising, which is net a better fuel source for the environment than coal. And then you've got things like self-driving cars that are coming and more efficiency in the U.S. So and people living in cities and not in suburbs like they used to. So there are a lot of positive things on the demand side as well.
So Dan Riker, we just got a couple more minutes with you. Walk us through how, at this point, sitting here where we are today, oil at new lows this week, down around $36 a barrel, down from over $110, kind of incredible. What's the path ahead you see for renewables? Given the pressure of Paris, everybody understands about climate change now, whether they say so or not. What's the path ahead that you see in terms of penetration, in terms of how much of energy demand can be served by renewables rather than fossil fuels?
So let's divide that quickly into two pieces. There's renewable electricity, solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, and then there's renewable fuels, ethanol, biodiesel.
Yep.
I think those renewable electricity sources are going to continue to grow as their prices drop, as climate mandates come into play, as incentives are provided by countries, many countries around the world. And I think you're going to see that growth in the United States as we've been seeing it of late. You're also going to see it in countries around the world. India just has set a target of 100,000 megawatts of solar. That's equivalent to all of the solar that was installed in the world as of 2014. they're making a major push in this area. So I think renewable electricity has got a very bright future. Now, I'm the first to admit that with low natural gas prices, which is really the big competitor for renewables, this is going to be a competitive situation. But there's really a silver lining even in that. We need natural gas to provide much of our baseload power increasingly in a country like the U.S. and others. And when the sun goes down or the wind stops blowing, we fire up natural gas turbines of various sorts. So these are complementary. So I think we do see a future where renewable electricity, natural gas, efficiency, as your guest just mentioned, those things come together to produce a lower carbon, cost-effective kind of economy.
We'll see over time how that works out, but it's amazing people in the renewable world are not freaking out when oil is at these super low prices, gas way down as well. Dan Riker, Board Chairman, President of the American Council on Renewable Energy. Thank you for being with us for a minute today, Dan.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here we are talking in 2015 about cheap oil and its global impacts this hour. Impacts on geopolitics, on economies, on renewable energy. Gregory Zuckerman is with us from The Wall Street Journal, author of The Frackers. Phil Verleger is with us. P.K. Verleger is his firm. He joins us today from Colorado. You can join us as well. Wind farmers, solar farmers, does cheap fuel, fossil fuel, mess with you, or are you all right now? In a few minutes, we're going to look at SpaceX bringing that big booster rocket back down. First time they've ever done it in Cape Canaveral last night. That was quite something to see. Interesting implications there for commercial work in space. Greg Zuckerman's with us from New York. Phil's in Carbondale, Colorado. David's calling from Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, David, thanks for calling. What are you up to?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm circumnavigating the United States, 8,600 miles on a dreamed car trip.
So you're not biking, you're not doing a Forrest Gump thing and running, you're on a car trip, and gas prices have been doing you a favor.
Big favor, yeah. A low of 153, I think, mid-country and deep south, and maybe 225 in D.C. for the high.
That's got to feel a lot better than it would a couple of years ago, but do you feel bad about spewing carbon emissions all over the USA, David?
I do feel bad, and I'm seeing, I think I'm seeing one of the consequences, too, in that I see very few luxury vehicles on the road, and I'm wondering if people are thinking like I am, that it doesn't pay to make a big investment in a fuel-using automobile, because after the happy times of cheap fuel, we're probably going to go back to super expensive fuel.
Well,
at least that's my guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it must depend where you're driving and what you're seeing. I just saw a number today that said sales off of car dealership lots up 40%. So a lot of people are driving cars. Certainly, it depends where you are. You can see a lot of big ones out there as well. David, on a road trip around the U.S., 7,000-plus miles, drive carefully there, and we appreciate your call. Benkin in Montreal, Canada. Benkin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hello to your guests.
Hello.
I want to say that this has nothing to do with renewable energy. I think it's more a financial war between Saudi Arabia and Russia, and especially Iran, because the demand's always there, but the price going down because those Russia and Iran cannot handle a price lower than $70 per barrel. So if this go on for the next 10 years, I mean, Russia will go bankruptcy and Iran will go bankruptcy. And I think there's a reason why the oil is going down.
Benkin, you're putting a different filter on this, and let us pick it up while I have time to do it. Phil, can you jump in on that? Let's change our perspective here to the geopolitical. This is tough for a lot of countries. You mentioned Venezuela, but there's Iran, as Benkin says. There's Russia. Is this Saudi Arabia sort of, doing them in?
The Saudis were clearly working for market share, and Greg had the right point saying they're putting on this. The point the Saudis understand that most people don't is that they can't do anything by raise their income by cutting production. And so there's a great piece on the Financial Times webpage by Mike Levy of the Council for Foreign Relations, The Folly of a Fiscal Break-Even Oil Price. The Saudis are literally in the same position as the fast food workers in New York City, who keep trying to get a raise in the minimum wage, or people in other parts of the country. They don't have any market power. So what the Saudis did was say, look, we have the lowest cost oil. It costs us 50 cents a barrel, really, probably at the margin to produce. We're going to produce as much as we can and bring the price down. Now, Russia, the caller from Montreal makes a very good point, but what the Russians are doing, since they're paying in rubles, they're making money. They're still profitable at these prices because the ruble went down, and they're buying all their machinery and everything in Russia. Some places, Venezuela gets hurt. Russia doesn't get hurt. Canada's hurt. Iran won't go bankrupt. Iran can also bring its costs down. The Schlumbergers and the other oil field services companies were charging very high prices because they were looking for the marginal worker who wasn't very good. Now they've laid them off. Mm-hmm. They're getting very productive. So they can produce oil now at about half the price. And so one can't look at this in a static sense. You bring the price down, costs come down, Iran will do all right, and we're going to see low oil prices for quite some time because there's no market power.
What about, Greg Zuckerman, what about oil industry investment? We've heard so much about the billions being invested, sometimes in really extreme oil recovery projects. At the same time, there's been a big move on, kind of socially minded, environmentally minded, to disinvest in oil. Is that going to happen on its own if prices stay down here?
Right. So I'm a big believer in letting markets do their thing. Solyndra and those kind of things don't often work out. Better to give incentive to people to make these investments. And as you suggest, the markets could do their thing and get us where we want to be. I mean, again, in anticipation of our conversation,
well, to be fair, if I may, the markets took us an awful long way toward global warming without working so very well. I mean, maybe we're turning now, but a lot of damage done.
But they did send prices high enough so that people started putting research and money into renewables. Yep. And again, it's surging and we've grabbed 7% and growing of U.S. electricity. And that's because prices got to be so high. You know, the larger point often is in this industry, there's a maxim that low prices solve low prices. And same thing with high prices. So I do think that high prices over the last few years has given incentive to people to invest in renewables, which is good for us all.
I mean, everybody's saying this is kind of – you say this is an attack by the Saudis on the American oil industry. Is it not an attack on renewables as well? Dan Riker sounded pretty optimistic, but do you buy how sanguine he is?
I think it's an attack by the Saudis on a lot of fronts. I mean, taking a step back, people forget that the USSR was crippled not really by President Reagan, but it was really by low oil prices initiated by the Saudis, and I believe they're doing this again. You can't underestimate the number of enemies they have, the Iranians, the Russians, U.S. Production, etc. So, yeah, they've got a lot of reasons to keep prices lower and to continue to until they feel so much pain in a few years, but it will take a few years.
One more call from oil country, Chris in Oklahoma. Thanks for calling, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have to say, on my daily route up to Oklahoma City, I live south of Oklahoma City, you will see just about any available space where you can store oil extracting equipment, pumps, trucks, other sorts of derricks, heavy equipment. It's just wherever they can find a place to park it, that's where it sits waiting for use. And it's looked like this for the last 6 to 9 months. And so if you live anywhere in the United States other than Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, or North Dakota, you're high-fiving. You love these gas prices. And, of course, we do here in Oklahoma. But obviously there is a tremendous result. The booming economy of Oklahoma City is starting to frack, if you will, in and of itself. Outstanding show. I appreciate you taking my call.
Great to have you, Chris. Phil Verleger, you saw those pump jacks, maybe not so busy on your drive through. What do you see ahead for oil country?
I see adjustments. Greg wrote about the frackers is a great book. I'll give him a really good call out. What we found is when natural gas prices went from $12 to $2 and less than $1 in the Marcellus, people kept drilling, production kept going up. You're going to see people producing and more oil in Oklahoma. What you're also going to see is a modification of the economy. There are well-trained people. There are lots of other jobs. Houston has got a very diversified economy. So the oil industry will be down, less employment in oil, more employment in other businesses. It's going to be an adjustment.
This has been a very eye-opening, mind-opening conversation. I'm grateful to the two of you for helping us have it. Phil Verleger and P.K. Verleger in Carbondale, Colorado. Thank you very much, Phil, for being with us.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Greg Zuckerman, author of The Frackers, the outrageous inside story of the new billionaire wildcatters, writes for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, thanks so much.
Great being here.
We go out with Toby Keith and Pump Jack in a moment. What last night's big rocket landing means for SpaceX, how they brought it down. This is On Point. Last night in Florida, the private commercial space carrier SpaceX landed a big booster rocket at Cape Canaveral after launching its load into space. First time ever for them, they could use that booster. Again, reuse it. It's a big deal. How did they do that? With us now from New York to explain how it happened is Tarek Malik, managing editor of space.com. Tarek Malik, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Listen with me for a moment to the joy as that big booster came back down on Cape Canaveral, Falcon 9. Cheers from the SpaceX team.
LZ-1, the Falcon has landed. Landing operators moving to procedure 11.100, section 3 on LZ-1, BNET, recovery.
Tarek, that is pretty awesome sound. It's been a while since I heard NASA quite that jubilant. And, of course, this isn't NASA. How do they do it? How do you bring a great big booster like that back down and set it down, I guess, right where they wanted it?
Yeah, with very carefully and with a lot of practice. You know, SpaceX has been trying to do this all year with this Falcon 9 rocket. They had several attempts over the ocean. They crashed into a barge twice.
Yeah.
And this last time, after a rocket explosion in June that was not related to this, you know, they it was like the charm for them. They have this Falcon 9 rocket that is capable of launching satellites and still carry extra fuel for the way back home. And so it launches its payload, in this case 11 commercial satellites, into orbit, separates from that second stage, and then turns around and makes a slow descent burn back to Earth. It is still going hypersonic speeds. They have four kind of X-wing fins to guide it back down to its landing spot, and for this case, they built a landing pad. They call it Landing Pad 1 at Cape Canaveral, as sort of the target zone, so it can fly itself back, slow itself. It fired its engines, I think, about three times on the way down to slow itself to landing, and you know, a picture perfect landing from what we saw on their feed. We know that they can be happier. They have a lot to celebrate, both last night and today.
But this is rocket science, and as you say, it hasn't been easy. They had their own problems with it. Elon Musk, who of course is the behind SpaceX, said that he ran out on the causeway to watch the landing just as the sonic boom, because this was coming down fast, the sonic boom reached him. He thought the rocket had exploded.
Yeah, it's just a confluence of timing. He thought it blew up, something that they're used to. They've seen that happen twice now on these previous launches. So he thought that it had failed. But in fact, when he came back in, went to launch control, he saw the video on the pad, and he was jubilant. It was very difficult. This is the first time we've ever seen an orbital rocket launch all the way up into orbit and then come back again and touch down. They hope to be able to prove that the rocket's in good health, that they could fly it again. They want to put this one on a shelf, though, maybe, to display as a trophy.
If this is so doable, why, over all the years that NASA has been sending up rockets, why hasn't it done the same thing? What we've seen again and again is those huge booster rockets taking things up, and then just, boom, they just splash in the ocean, gone.
Yeah, it is substantially more easier to just kind of toss away parts of the rocket to shed the mass to get something into orbit than it is to really save that part and bring it back. You know, the NASA space shuttle itself was supposed to be completely reusable with flyback boosters, and the technological hurdles at the time really prevented that from being the case. NASA even tried this type of a rocket, a vertical launch, vertical landing, the DCX in the 90s. That project got shelved, too. SpaceX has shown with its stepping stone approach and its, you know, mishaps, being able to survive some failures. They had another rocket like this, a test version that blew up in Texas when it malfunctioned. So they've been really just attacking it head on with a vision. Elon Musk just wants to make this a reality, and today he did.
Tariq, is this the Soviets for a long, long time? We always did with our astronauts these ocean landings. You see them splash down, come down a little capsule on a parachute. Soviets brought things down on land. Was that with a similar technology or something else? Were they doing vertical rocket landing there?
Well, they were doing a controlled crash. They bring back their Soyuz space capsules on land with some retro rockets.
Tariq, I missed that. They bring them back with the retro rockets, but it comes down harder than what we saw with Falcon 9?
Well, it comes down kind of, astronauts have described it to me as like a being in a car crash. You're in this Soyuz capsule. It has three pieces, an orbital module, a crew capsule, and then a propellant section, the part with the engine on it. On the way down, those two sections that don't have the crew in them, they're thrown away. They eject and they burn up in the atmosphere. The crew capsule comes back down. It deploys a parachute, descends a bit, and then they have these little retro rockets that fire just at the last moment to slow it down even more. It's a one-shot spacecraft. So once that happens, once those astronauts and cosmonauts are back on the ground, that capsule, they can't use it again. While that works for Russia, now SpaceX really wants to be able to use these rockets again. It's a more ginger landing, trying to be a bit more delicate with the rocket all the way down to be able to touch down on these landing legs it has, and then maybe just gas it up and go again.
What exactly was the first last night? Was it just first for SpaceX? Have others done this?
Well, this was a big first for SpaceX of achieving this feat, and then also of bringing a rocket back from orbit. Earlier this year in November, one of SpaceX's rivals, Blue Origin, founded by Jeff Bezos, launched its own rocket called New Shepard. It's a smaller craft. It's suborbital, so it does not go all the way up into orbit. And that launched up to kind of just the boundary up into space, came back down, landed at Blue Origin's testing ground in West Texas. Another big thing that SpaceX did is they didn't hide the test that they did it. They launched this mission, and they landed the rocket live on their webcast stream. Their rival, Blue Origin, performed the test and then announced it after the fact. Very quickly after the fact, but still it wasn't a live test.
Yeah.
And so that's a bold attempt or try to just do it all live in real time.
It was very exciting to watch. We're grateful to you for unfolding how it's worked. Tariq Malik, Managing Editor at Space.com. Thank you very much for joining us, Tariq.
A pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.